My name is Julie Tai, and I am the Director of Chapel at Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Fuller Studios' audio stream of sermons drawn from campus chapels and preachers throughout our extended community.
Acts 5, 1 through 11. But a man named Ananias, with the consent of his wife Sapphira, sold a piece of property. With his wife's knowledge, he kept back some of the proceeds and brought only a part and laid it at the apostles' feet. Ananias, Peter asked, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back part of the proceeds of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, were not the proceeds at your disposal? How is it that you have contrived this deed in your heart? You did not lie to us, but to God. Now when Ananias heard these words, he fell down and died. And great fear seized all who heard it. The young men came and wrapped up his body, then carried him out and buried him.
After an interval of about 3 hours, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. Peter said to her, tell me whether you and your husband sold the land for such and such a price. And she said, yes, that was the price. Then Peter said to her, how is it that you have agreed together to put the Spirit of the Lord to the test? Look, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out. Immediately she fell down at his feet and died. When the young men came in, they found her dead. So they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear seized the whole church and all who heard of these things. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God.
A few weeks ago, my family evacuated from our little place in Monrovia to escape the fires that were bearing down on the town. We were really grateful that we were able to put together enough Southwest points that we could fly to my wife's family in Colorado. But as 2020 would have it, as soon after we arrived, my sister and brother-in-law discovered that our young nephew and niece had been victimized by years of violence and abuse at the hands of another young neighbor. And this very acute trauma threatened to spill out into their interactions with our children, with my children, for the simple fact that we were now living in their space. In an email exchange with a friend and a colleague, I was asked, you know, how we were doing and how my kids were responding. And I remember stopping and thinking to myself, well, how am I doing? I mean, my family had just been displaced from our home due to historic wildfires borne by an ecological crisis. And that happened in the midst of a global pandemic, an unfolding economic crisis, and an ongoing national reckoning with racial injustice, only for us to land in a situation in which we now have to navigate all sorts of these complex family dynamics in order just to protect my children from the fallout of childhood trauma. If I'm being perfectly honest with you, it felt overwhelming, paralyzing even. It was just crisis upon catastrophe upon chaos. But here's the thing. Nothing that I've just described to you is unique or exceptional to me. All of us, in varying degrees, are in the midst of a season that feels almost apocalyptic. And that's probably because it is. It's a moment of unveiling or revealing, which is the meaning of the word apocalypsis, right? It's this revealing that exposes how fragile we really are, the utter arrogance with which we normally operate, the brokenness of the systems we inhabit, and at the very same time, the various idols that we habitually turn to in order to manage all that chaos. So to me, it's no small wonder that the Biblical Witness features story after story of God's people responding to situations in which chaos, disruption, and uncertainty seem to rule the day. And this passage in Acts is no exception. In this first few chapters of Acts, the followers of Jesus have just watched their leader ascend to heaven after witnessing him die as a victim of state-sanctioned violence. And then in the aftermath of this collective trauma, not only are there disputes about who exactly is in charge of this lot, but they have to vote on replacing the man who betrayed them in this epic plot twist. Then, out of nowhere, people who don't speak their language suddenly understand them, and they're left trying to discern what this unwieldy, untamed, unpredictable spirit is up to. And just when they think they've got it figured out, they're arrested and thrown into jail for running afoul of the religious gatekeepers and the political powers that be. Needless to say, for them, it was crisis upon catastrophe, upon chaos. And in the midst of all that, we get this really interesting story about Ananias and Sapphira. Here would be my elevator pitch if I was going to turn this into a movie. Husband and wife lie about something they don't need to lie about, and they die as a result. Before they both lose their lives, though, Peter poses this question to Ananias that recalls, in my mind, Jesus' parable of the prodigal son. When the father says to the elder son, who's out sort of brooding and jealous of his younger son, the father says, "Everything that belongs to me is yours." In other words, in a complete inversion of the father's gratuitous love that we get in the parable of the prodigal son, the behavior of Ananias and Sapphira is also gratuitous, equally so. It's absolutely unnecessary and completely self-defeating. But that, of course, is the nature of the idol. Whatever you make of this passage and the severity of the Spirit's activity, right? It's clear that the Spirit takes infidelity to the community seriously. In fact, it's deadly serious. But importantly, what dies here are not two individuals. As Willie Jennings points out in his commentary in Acts, this is the death of what he calls the sovereign couple. It's precisely as a couple that Ananias and Sapphira engage in these economic calculations, right? And they hoard up money for themselves when they didn't have to. It's precisely as a couple that Satan fills their hearts and turns them away from their community. As Jennings puts it, this couple believed it may lie to the Holy Spirit. And couples now, today, are often led to believe that they may do the same because too many churches have told them that their life together supersedes our life together. In other words, under the pressure brought on by disruption and uncertainty and driven by fears of scarcity, the married couple here is revealed to be an idol. I made a similar claim a couple years ago in a book I published called Breaking the Marriage Idol. Let's see if I have a copy of it somewhere. Ah, yes, in fact, I do. Look at this. Shameless plug if you're interested in hearing more. But in this book, I basically said that despite how U.S. Christians claim to be all about family values and advocate politically for their right to support biblical views of marriage, the church, I said, operates with an idolatrous vision of marriage that organizes and orients our shared lives together. And this idolatry, which holds up marriage as the paradigm for understanding what it means to be a disciple, a fully functioning member of the Christian community, and even a human being, this idolatry not only divides the church from within, but it undermines its credibility as a witness in the public sphere. So I basically posed in the book what I thought were some pretty reasonable questions, right? What if marriage wasn't the model to which everyone was encouraged and sometimes coerced into conforming? What if, as the examples of Paul and Jesus provide us, marriage were not the default category for understanding the Christian person, much less what it means to be fully human? What if marriage were neither the primary marker of adulthood, nor the answer for some lack or emptiness, nor the outlet for some unmet sexual desire, nor the consummation of an idealized future? What if, rather than marriage, being a person in relation to a community was the primary category for orienting and animating our shared life? I'd like to tell you that the book changed the landscape of U.S. evangelicalism, right? But as it turns out, people don't like it when you poke at their idols. It was probably naive of me to think that my little book would cause anything to change. After all, idols don't go down without a fight. Still, as I read Acts, especially this passage in Acts, one thing becomes painfully clear. The Spirit of God has some pretty strong feelings, not just about idolatry in general, but about this specific brand of idolatry in particular. And this really genuinely unsettling passage, The Spirit is calling us as individuals and as a community to something different, to something truly and deeply alternative, a new community, a new way of being in the world, a new kind of family. What never ceases to amaze me is that when we're able to respond to the Spirit's promptings, as we see in this passage in Acts, however disruptive and unsettling they may be, we not only discover what we need to do in order to defame our idols and the false sense of security that they deliver, but we also find these incredible new avenues for being a faithful presence and a credible witness in a world that's upended by chaos. It's a totally unexpected antidote to what ails us, which is exactly how the Spirit operates. Recall John 3:8 that says, "The wind blows wherever it will, and you hear the sound that it makes, but you don't know where it comes from and where it's going." So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. The unexpected, the unanticipated response to the chaos of our lives. Such is life lived in response to the Spirit's call. So imagine with me for a moment what it might look like if we responded to the chaos and uncertainty of the present moment by defaming one of our long-standing idols. What if, in a time of pronounced national and international economic uncertainty, economic crises that are overwhelmingly and disproportionately affecting women and mothers, what if the people of God in the world pursued marriage not as a means for shoring up their financial well-being, the financial well-being of the sovereign couple and their kin and their children, but as a way of living out a mad kind of generosity, a generosity that spilled out economically into the community? What if in a time in which the global pandemic has shuttered us all behind closed doors, a time in which our single brothers and sisters are not merely socially distanced, but in many cases are in utter isolation? What if Christians reconceived of their marriages not as a call to protect, again, the sovereign couple and their offspring at all costs, but as a gospel imperative to open up their most intimate of spaces to those who might very well pose a threat to their well-being? And what if, in a time in which there is a great deal of uncertainty regarding the civil rights and liberties of the racially and sexually marginalized, a time in which the laws of the land might very well undergo regressive and life-threatening changes, what if the Christian community held up marriage not as a mechanism for satisfying our self-directed desires, but as a means for enacting justice in the world? At the end of the day, the question I think this passage in Acts is inviting us to consider is this: what's the story we are going to tell? When we look back from the future at now, the year 2020, and it's been one heck of a year, we may very well realize that in the face of a seemingly infinite number of overlapping catastrophes, we turned collectively and individually to what we thought was safe and secure, what we thought was comfortable and certain. We may tell a story in which we turn to these idols even at each other's expense. But we could tell a very different kind of story. One that goes something like this: when God acts, nothing is ever the same. And no one is left unscathed.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.